That is a weather report.
Oh no, StreamYard has lost access to your Twitch account.
Sure, you'll have to fix that.
Yeah, I don't know. Something happened, I guess. That password is incorrect. Did someone change the password on my Twitch account? Maybe. Hey, welcome to the Backpack Show,
where we talk about success and find insights from unusual places. We have a show for you today. We're going to talk with Tracy Shelton, founder of Alamo Kitchen, which is a shared-use commercial kitchen space and incubator designed and developed for food-focused entrepreneurs. We're going to talk to her, and we're going to talk to, now this is interesting because I had never had an evolutionary scientist on the show before, but we're about to. So we have lots and lots of questions for Professor Randolph Ness, who asked that we just call him Randy, which I think is very nice, author of Good Reasons for Bad Feelings. I saw an article talking about how things like depression and anxiety served an evolutionary purpose, and I found that intriguing. So we're going to talk with him today about that.
And also, before I forget, congratulations to the New England Patriots. I mean, Tampa Bay Buccaneers last night won completely by the Patriots. So I think we got a lot to talk about today. And look, Chloe is back on station.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz, welcoming you to The Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
Deanna's here.
Hey, Nancy. Deanna.
All our Scottish folks Nancy are coming here. In.
So glad to see Nancy. Hey. What a day, what a day, what a day. I'm going to try my best to remember to actually do our ads at the beginning.
You have to do them all. I mean, you could like split them up.
I know. We could do them like this too. StreamYard. Okay, that was good. Castos. Okay, that was good. Johnsonville. They seem nice.
People don't know what Castos is.
Yeah. Castos is a podcasting app. That's why I put Peapods. See pods, podcasting. Castos.com is a podcasting platform that allows you to host your podcast. We now have an audio version of the Backpack Show because so many people kept twisting my arm to do it. And I said, well, fine.
I was not one of those people.
Nope. But I got one. StreamYard. This is how you make a show like this. See brogan.me/StreamYard. Make your own show. But.
It's super easy. But you got to bring your own evolutionary scientist.
There you go. Pub site, authors, people who write books about feelings could have their own website super fast and easy. Go to pub-site.com. It is $20 a month. You get 14 days free. In the first 2 hours, you can make your website and then have 13 and a half days to marvel at how beautiful it was. Oh, amazing. We are sponsored absolutely ironically by Johnsonville. If you want sausage, though, Carrie will hook you up. Carrie@chrisbrogan.com. Get you some juicy sausages.
And when I misspoke, it's Professor Randolph Nessie.
Is it Nessie? Mm-hmm. I have been saying it wrong, too. I've been saying Ness. Well, thank goodness we got the correction.
Yes.
That's what we come on the show for, to learn, right?
Yes. Oh, I come to every show. I come to completely waiting to be filled with knowledge. Like, I don't pretend to be an expert in evolutionary science or commercial kitchens or cooking at all. Well, I, in fact, purposely became so bad at cooking that nobody would want me to do it because I just don't like it.
Well, now we got to talk to the wizard of cooking. We got to talk to Tracy Shelton. So let's learn a little bit about Alamo Kitchens. Hey, Tracy, how the heck are you?
Hey, good morning. I'm great. How are you guys?
Best ever. So people Best don't ever? Understand.
You didn't ask her what's cooking. Come on. What's You're the king of bad jokes.
I need a redo. I want to be best ever.
All right, hang on a minute. All right, so we got to bring Tracy Shelton on here from Alamo Kitchens. Hey, Tracy, what's cooking?
There you go. It's perfect.
Do I ever do what's expected? Tracy, so you don't have just a plain old restaurant. You don't have drink specials. You don't have, get some free apps when the game's on kind of a thing. You run a whole different kind of kitchen at Alamo Kitchens. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, we do. So we are a shared use commercial kitchen space.
Shared use commercial kitchen space.
Shared use commercial kitchen.
Warm us up on that one.
What does that all mean, right? We when we first started, I coined this, we were a culinary co-working space. Mm-hmm. And people were like, what the heck is that? But just like folks would go and work somewhere else while they were, when they were supposed to work from home, this is a space where chefs, caterers, food manufacturers can come in, rent space in our kitchen and prepare their great product to feed all of us. So we have food manufacturers that are in our space. We've got caterers. We've got meal prep people. We've got beverage makers, salsa makers. They come in. they prepare what they, you know, they prepare their wares and they go and they sell it to the public.
I never thought about that before, but isn't overhead is part of the problem for a lot of food entrepreneurs? Like, it's expensive to have a commercial-grade kitchen.
Absolutely. So that's the whole point, right? Is that we reduce the barrier to entry to getting into the food business, to be able being able to expand in the food business. I'm a business coach, and I was coaching all these food businesses who had a great product, but they couldn't sell beyond the farmer's market. So here in Texas, we operate under cottage laws. A lot of places do. And at some point, when you're making it out of your home kitchen that's not inspected, you can only sell it directly to people, right? But if you want to get into a grocery store, or you want to ship it somewhere, you have to have a commercial kitchen, and folks just can't afford it. So it's a shared use kitchen where we share the cost, right? And it makes it an opportunity for folks to get in and grow their business.
I have two things at once. One is that I just have to, I'm so sad I missed your New Year with Black Eyed Peas and
Kool-Aid. Oh my gosh. Let me just say, so we may talk about COVID and pivoting. So one of the things that we had to do in COVID to kind of speed up is we had to bring on some other products and services. We were working to get money to update our website, which we're still hoping to do, where the folks could be, the folks in our kitchen, we could get catering for them off of the site, right? Mm-hmm. Well, had to accelerate that. So we brought on a resident chef. Her name is Vicky. She is amazing. She owns a company called Crepelandia, and she cooks in our kitchen. We brought Vicky on as our resident chef to kind of boost this idea of this is a place to come find people that cook. And she started making these great things. So she said, we did Thanksgiving dinners, we did Christmas dinners, and, you know, getting the name out there. Yeah, you should come here for catering. Man, then she said, let's do Black Eyed Peas and cornbread for New Year's Eve. These were, and my mom is listening, and so I apologize, Mama, in advance. These are the best Black Eyed Peas I had ever had in my life. They were so good.
And we say second best for your
top
mom.
Top three. Could you say top three?
Can we do over?
Yeah. Mom, she did not mean that, Mom.
They were so
she's
good.
Feeling awkward because she's on film. She slipped and fell.
Yeah, I did. They were the second best Black Eyed Peas I've ever had. They were so good. So yeah, you missed it, but we got you. We got you come next New Year's Eve.
So there's a lot to this business. And like you said, because of COVID, because of the way things are changing, there's a lot of ways to look at it. So Chip was talking about this is good for regulatory and all that. There's a whole class of human who has a product that's good enough that all their friends beg them to bring it to every event back when we went to places. And that's just they say all the things that you feel good inside your belly, but you don't know, can I really do it? Yeah. One of the things that you could do there is you show them not only just how to make it in the environment that's going to pass legal muster, but what's it going to take to make 26,000 of something? Do you get into that a bunch? How does that work? Talk about how you coach that.
So we provide coaching to folks that want us to coach them and help them get to the next level, because there's one thing to start, and then there's another whole level of when you have to scale up so that you can reach a capacity that can feed lots and lots of people beyond your friends and family. So that's one of the services that we are now providing to these people in our space, and even folks who are just they're foodies or they have some kind of business, even if it's not food, maybe it's HHB type products, CPG products, and they want to scale up. It's really just walking them through the process, aligning them with the right resources, reviewing what they've got or what they're considering to make sure that it makes sense and it gets them to where they want to go. And also, you know, one of the ways you succeed, in my opinion, is that you have to fail or learn. And so walking them through the learnings, right? So you did this and here was the result. Here's how we could retool and do it better the next time, because it's so, so key that you have a mentor and someone really looking at it from a perspective that's where they're not in it with you, right? They're in it with you, but it's at the end of the day, it's yours. And so they have an objective opinion, and that's what we provide through our coaching for folks.
Tracy, you said many letters there when you were talking about different types of foods and products. Can you explain them?
Oh, gosh. Okay.
You said CPG, consumer packaged goods. And then you said the other one that I read.
Hey, I asked her. Did I ask you? I'm just
giving the one that I heard.
Let the woman speak.
Uh-oh. So I don't know which ones I'm talking about. Consumer packaged goods, CPG,
Something with an H.
HHB.
Okay.
Home health beauty. So okay. Folks that would do lotions and soaps, that would be home health and beauty. And folks that even people who do, we have a great, a lady in our space who makes the most amazing caramel toffee popcorn and this, oh my gosh, fudge. Great, right? So just, but walking them through, this tastes really good, but let's look at your label and let's make sure that this label is going to pass a state inspection, or if it has to go through the FDA, what does a federal inspection look like? To make sure that you have the nutrients on there, you have the ingredients, right, that it's labeled correctly, and you can send it out. So those become the little things that people get tripped up on, right? So I know how to make my grandma's famous fill in the blank, but getting it from the pan to someone else's mouth, that becomes a challenge. And what are all the pieces that you, all the I's you need to dot, along the way? That's the other way that we help. So we provide you the space to cook it, and then we provide you some support and expertise as you get ready to move that from the kitchen into the mouths of.
Remember, your mom's watching.
Right.
Saying.
That's what we're getting. Well, mom is great.
Pretzel rolls, gotta love them. Hey,
those are great.
Where are they?
Pretzel roll sandwiches. Oh my gosh, yes.
So one of the things that you and I talked about for a second backstage was ghost kitchens. And it's another one of those things that people don't exactly know about, but there's this new kind of mode out there where a place will set up a place for people to cook, and it'll be five restaurants hidden into one, so that a place like a DoorDash or an Uber Eats can come and get your Applebee's and your Red Robin. I almost always hear them as those like middling family casual kind of places. It's not like quality per se. Do you do anything with that, or is that part of what you, how do you foresee that fitting into the landscape of what, you know, how we're going to eat? What's your vote on it?
I think it's here to stay, and it's going to be more prominent. It really, really is. And one of the things that we're doing in our space is trying to figure out how to help our clients leverage that ghost kitchen concept, right? They're in the kitchen anyway, they're cooking in our space. The problem becomes the consistency of the orders, right? So if you're open all day, are you going to make enough money that it makes sense for you to be renting kitchen space? And so for us, it becomes, you know, maybe we do something collaborative for those folks who have a product that we can sell for them through the kitchen. So maybe the kitchen, the ghost kitchen is our ghost kitchen is open all day, and you have a variety of things that you can choose from depending on the time of day that you're ordering or the day of the week that you're ordering. So the struggle for a really small entrepreneur that's not a Chili's or an Applebee's with lots and lots of capital is really just how do you scale and how do you afford it? When you're not really sure when people are going to order and if they're going to order enough to cover your overhead.
Do you have one, Carrie?
Yes, I was going to. Well, I was like, wait, you were unmuting and stuff. So I was like expecting something really good. I was giving you a second. I was curious about what do you do to make the foods shelf stable, like for a little bit and fresh? Like, do you try to get them straight to the end user as quickly as possible? Or like, is there sometimes an inevitable delay and you have to make sure that these foods that normally would go straight to the plate in your home kitchen can last for like just a little bit longer?
Yes, is the answer to that. And if my children were behind me, they would say time temperature control, time temperature control, because that's the thing, right? I grew up, I'm from Texas, and food is a big thing in our family. It's a way that we share life, right? We would gather around the kitchen, and rarely would we sit at a table. It was really in the kitchen, and we would watch my mother and my aunts and my grandmother cook, and then we'd all kind of eat together. One of the things that happened all the time in my family is we would prepare this food and it would sit out like all day long, right? And we would kind of graze on it. And now, knowing what I know, I'm like, holy smokes, Batman, that is so wrong. My mother would say, no one ever got sick, it's fine. But when you're doing this commercially, you really want to make sure that you that you're keeping people safe, right? And so that means that we're regulating the temperature, we're regulating how long it's out. And so because we're cooking it in the kitchen and then taking it somewhere else, we are looking at, does it need a warming tray? Does it need a warming box? Does it need a cooling tray? And our folks get, they get done and they go right to delivery most times. If it's a cater job, if it's something that's packaged, it's how do we seal it so that, you know, we seal it and it's in a stay safe seal, right? Or it's jarred. And because we have to make sure that everything coming out of the kitchen is as fresh as it can be and as safe as possible.
All right. Well, Carrie, you're going to ask that question because I like that question, but I have one more question, which is in restaurateuring, there's all this stuff that's out the window, right? I say this about grocery as well, is that, for instance, when you make a menu, the thing that's in the box in the menu is the thing where there's the most margin. So for instance, if something costs you $6 to make, you put that as, you know, a very important special at $14 in the margin, in the little red box, because that's what draws people's eyes. And we don't want to guess. And there's so many things on the menu. We go, I'll have this thing in a box because it's in a box. It must be good. Can't do that in this new mode. There's all these new things that, like, the way we market food has changed and all that. Mm-hmm. Has that crept into what you're teaching? And what do you, how do you address that?
Yes, because one of the, there are lots of things that make a business fail, right? And we could, that's a whole nother show. But when you're in a restaurant, you really want to control your labor and your food cost. Those are the biggest costs that you have. And so you really don't want your food cost to be more than 30%. And one of the things that I want to say to folks is, you know, you go to XYZ place and it's like French fries for a dollar, right? Okay. But when it's they have more capital, they have, right, they have more resources. They can use it as a loss leader and that's fine. With a small entrepreneur, you can't sell French fries for a dollar because, you know, it maybe cost you 30 cents in potatoes and 30 cents in labor and, you know, 20 cents in delivery. Then you start to lose that margin. So I'm going to answer your question, Chris, I promise. But I want to encourage people to shop local and small. And when a small business, particularly a restaurant, tells you that you need to pay or ask you to pay $10 for it, give them the $10 because there's layers upon layers upon layers of cost to get that to you. And the margin is really, really slim. And so as a, you know, when we think about costs, it's a 30%, is what you want to control, to try to control your food costs. The higher the quality of the food that you're giving, the higher the quality of the meat and the vegetables, it's going to cost you more. But one of the things that we teach folks is let's try to have some of the same ingredients. So control your menu such that you're using the same ingredients or many of similar ingredients. So then that you're maximizing your food costs and you're reducing your waste. Because that's the other part, right? Is if I have too many things on the menu with, you know, a beef and a lamb and a turkey and if I got all these pieces and I don't sell enough, then I have this food cost that food waste that also affects your bottom line. So did I answer your question or did I just rail about?
I kept thinking about back when we used to be allowed to travel, you know, having a multiple pieces that could make many outfits, like just a few things you could wear different ways. That's what that made me think of. But I have a question. What of all the things your mom cooks is your favorite?
Okay, so what does my mom cook that's my favorite?
I have more than one favorite. That's okay.
Yeah. So my mom makes a really great, probably my favorite thing for my mom is her broccoli and rice casserole. Mm. It's so good. I really like green vegetables. And my brother really likes the cheese, right? So she chunks it full of both so that everyone's happy. And it's creamy and she made some yesterday, as a matter of fact, and it feels like home and it feels like mom.
Well, I'm a dessert person. What do we got for dessert? What's on
the menu? Dessert, chocolate cake.
Mm. Yes. Now we're talking. Yeah,
chocolate cake. Mm-hmm. She did not make that yesterday. Mother, you could make me a chocolate cake.
If you loved her.
If you
love it.
We all know food means love. So if there's no chocolate cake, we could talk about that.
Where's the love? That's right.
Tracy Shelton, it's been great. If you could stick around, please do. We've got a little bit of a panel that we'll drag you into a little bit later on. But thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of that cooking goodness with us.
Thank you.
Remember, we don't have any ads, so we're going right
almost
to
Almost makes me sad that I can't cook.
Almost. Almost.
Or that I choose not to.
Cooking classes coming 2021. You can get them.
No, that won't help me because I don't want to. It's not going to make me like it anymore.
Now, from someone who helps people navigate their way through the kitchens to a not only a physician, but a founder of a field of medicine, you know, because why be basic and just know somebody who's a doctor? They can found things. Dr. Randy, Carrie was not expecting broccoli as the best food answer. Hey, doctor, how the heck are you?
That is true.
Nice to see you guys.
Good to connect.
So, Professor Nessie.
That's it. You got it. Yep.
I had that so wrong. So your website sure is professional. It looks like a very physician-y website. Like, is that
physician-y?
Well, you know, that's I have a question related to this. I do. Oh. I have a question related to this. Are there boundaries or requirements on having to sort of maintain a certain modicum of you know your stature that make it so you wouldn't? Would you present this differently if you weren't all of the things that you are?
Well, you know, if you're a psychiatrist, and it's a whole big thing. Do you want your patients knowing that you like to stick your fingers into the popcorn? We've been, you know, it's you can't do that. And right. and your cat and your dog and your, you know, you got to maintain some kind of a boundary there. A few people don't, but it's kind of icky if people, that they can't be the same with you if they know too much about your personal life. And so most psychiatrists, I think, very sensibly just keep a little boundary there. As for websites, hey, if you're an academic and a professional, in general, it's fun to put stuff up there that you're really working on and thinking about.
It's interesting, the whole concept of, you know, the boundary that you have to create so that you can help somebody work through their boundaries.
I guess that becomes you could put it that way, yeah.
Nobody goes to a dentist with bad teeth, right? Nobody wants to think that their psychiatrist has their own problems, but they do.
So there's another thing is putting up your own problems. A few people do that, but that too, it gets a little iffy, doesn't it? Yeah.
Although, Chris, you're very transparent about any struggles that you have, even as an entrepreneur.
Right. Yeah, my premise is almost the opposite, although no one's coming to me for mental health help, which I guess is probably one big important reason. Yeah. I walk into everything saying, hey, I deal with clinical depression. And that's almost always like handing the business card part of the conversation because I want people to know it's a yes and, not some kind of a weird stopgap. I want to go backwards a little bit. This is humorous given the concept, but evolutionary medicine and Darwinian medicine, I want to go backwards to see about how did this come about and what made you think, well, this is what people aren't figuring out yet. They didn't quite understand this yet.
You know, being a psychiatrist, I think, is just about the greatest profession there is because you really do get to help people. My friends say, oh, why are you going into psychiatry? Don't you really want to do something more practical, like cut on people? I said, no. And I found it so satisfying because if you have enough time, as I did in my job, to actually sit down and talk with people, sometimes over weeks or months, almost everybody can be helped. On the other hand, it's a frustrating field because everybody got some different idea about what's going on. Some people say you got a brain disease. Other people say, you know, it was your early experience with your mother. Other people say it's your marriage. Other people say, you know, you don't have enough faith. Other people, you know, it's all kinds of different things. And I got very frustrated with that. So I started hanging out with biologists, and it was just this revelation. They said, well, don't all psychiatrists study evolutionary biology? I said, well, no. And they said, well, they should, because all of us who study behavior, we all study, and we try to figure out why animals do what they do from an evolutionary reason. You should get into this. And I suddenly realized that my whole super-duper education had left this giant gap, you know? And I started asking these new questions. I mean, before I got into evolution and psychiatry, I had to figure out about evolution and medicine in general. And here's something everybody's interested in. Well, I mean, why isn't the body better, really? I mean, why do we have wisdom teeth? Thank you very much. No, thank you. Appendix? And then for women, that birth canal is just too narrow. You know, it it should be much wider.
I mean, it makes sense if the guy wants to have multiple wives during the course of his life, because, you know.
There's another idea, right?
Chance of trading up.
Yeah, right. Well, that keeps it's happening these days, isn't it? But we started asking a new question. That's the key to everything here. Instead of asking why one person gets sick, we started asking, hey, why do we all have bodies and minds that are so vulnerable? So it's like this big switch. I mean, all my education before was from a mechanic's point of view. It was like, how does it work? What's broken? How to fix it? And these biologists taught me to ask this whole other question about, so why is there a narrow birth canal? And then I took this right to psychiatry and started asking myself, so why do emotions exist at all? Instead of why some people get depressed. And from there on, it's been just fabulous growth and everybody's interested. And it's turning out to be practically useful also.
There is such a depth to when you start looking up evolutionary medicine. As I was doing a little bit of prep for this, I was thinking, this is not, you know, so tell me about your mother. Like you could sum up Freud in a couple of sentences. You can't with evolutionary medicine. There's so much to this. And it sort of feels, there's a great amount of academia required to even sort of parse the way you're coming at it. How do you put the face on that when there's just someone on the couch or whatever? How do you take all that?
You're talking about evolutionary medicine and evolutionary psychiatry. Let's do evolutionary medicine for just a second.
Sure.
And we're right in the middle of a damned virus that's evolving. And trying to predict how it's going to evolve is like the biggest question for our species right now. Is it going to evolve to get milder because the milder ones spread faster? Or is it going to evolve to get nastier and kill more people because it spreads faster that way? We don't know the answer to that. We do know it's evolving. And we're hoping it keeps that same spike protein right there just the same, because that's what our vaccines go after. But talk about something that's really, really practical. Another practical implication of evolutionary medicine is cancer. And so why the heck do we get cancer at all? Why aren't our bodies better protected? And the answer is our bodies are very well protected. We have all these mechanisms for detecting cells that start going out of control and knocking them off. And as long as those things work well enough, we're okay. But one guy down in Florida, a fellow named Robert Gatenby, has started thinking more deeply evolutionarily about this. And he's realizing that, you know, the cells that surround cancer cells help to inhibit them. And so if you just blast it with maximum dose chemotherapy, as if you're trying to kill off the enemy, that might open up the ecosystem for those bad cells, the worst cells, to grow faster yet. Because what's going on in the tumor is different cells in the tumor are competing with each other to grow faster. And he started experimenting with different strategies for chemotherapy, where he's finding that lower doses lead to better outcomes. To say nothing of, and this is so exciting to me that these fundamental basic science ideas that started off as just, hey, let's ask a different question. Let's ask, you know, why we get cancer at all instead of why some people get cancer. And now it's turned into a different strategy for chemotherapy that might make, I mean, it's so exciting. We can go on to evolutionary psychiatry quick if you want to, but
Chip thinks we're all in a simulation. He says the reason for all these things is we're inside a giant video game and some teenage gamer somewhere is making the decisions. That's a terrifying thought, right?
Maybe.
Oh, no.
I do want to talk about the idea behind the premise of the book. I think that, you know, the book Good Reasons for Bad Feelings, just the title alone piqued my interest because, you know, I'm only just starting to come along with the concept of, you know, how certain chemicals can impact depression and all that. And this is a whole other thing. So, you know, let me get on the couch. when I went through all the basic SSRIs, I hated all of them. None of them worked especially well for me. And they also took away my sex drive, which I thought, I'm not choosing to be a human if I don't get a sex drive with this.
Yep, forget that. Yep.
And then my doctor said to me, hey, do you want to try something experimental? And I thought, who wouldn't? And I had ketamine. I blanked on the name for a minute. I had ketamine treatment. Ridiculously effective for me. Treatment, 11 months. I went 11 months without a massive depression issue for 11 whole months. And when I felt depression coming on, whether or not this is psychosomatic, you don't have to correct me, I'll believe it's true. I felt this sort of tingly feeling, almost as if residual chemicals were saying to me, I got this, don't worry, this isn't a big deal anymore, we got this, from that one treatment. So I want to talk about, I want to give you that first to say, that's kind of how I'm dealing.
Right.
Your book has a whole other storyline. Your book says we could look at this a whole other way. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. When I first got into this business, I looked in my 1,000-page psychiatry textbook, said, "But hey, why are emotions there?" And it was like one half page. So I spent a year just reading about emotions and finally came to a really simple conclusion that emotions are there because individuals who went into a special state in some special situation had a big advantage. You know, if you smell lion's breath on your shoulder, you know, and you experience nothing, you're gone, right? But if you have this, oh my God, I'm getting out of here, and your heart starts pounding and you start breathing fast and you run as fast as you can, you know, that's called a panic attack. And a panic attack in that situation is a really, really good thing. I think for most people, it's really easy to see how anxiety is useful. So maybe since we don't have much time, we should just go right to depression. And I don't even use that word much because when I say depression, everybody means like depression is like you're really sick. It's really bad. So I use low mood to mean feeling kind of like you're depressed, but who knows if it's normal or abnormal, you know? And the question is, are there any situations in which it's best not to be all perky and optimistic? Are there any situations we encounter in life when it's really better to just hunker down? And before I answer that, maybe we should just go to COVID again. And there are all these newspaper articles about the mental health epidemic, right? And there sure are a lot of people feeling awful, right? I mean, we can't do the things we want to do. We can't start our restaurant. We can't see our lover even half the time. I mean, it's just terrible for people. But does this like mean that everybody's sick? I think telling everybody that they're sick and they need treatment, what do you guys think about that?
I think you just kind of accidentally explained a problem I've been having with agoraphobia and panic attacks. I don't have agoraphobia. It's not one of my free things that came with depression. But panic attacks were anxiety I get all the time. But every time I leave the house right now, I get a panic attack the minute my foot hits the concrete.
Is that right?
And I thought, well, that's stupid. Like, what an annoying thing to have. Like, I know why. But now you're saying, gee, that's pretty important, probably useful. It's probably good that your body's giving you chemical symbols and say, maybe go back in the house. But
is
that's
that it. Why? Like, I'm thinking about that. So from an evolutionary standpoint, do we still have hold over things that are like, if you go outside right now, you like there's a 2-4% chance you'll die. So let's not. Like, yeah, is that right. What's happening?
Right. You know, we aren't very realistic, are we, about what's dangerous and what's not? Sometimes we are like, I'm too scared. I mean, I'm too scared and I don't know why. The rest of the time, people are going around and hugging people without masks and, you know, really risking their lives. So how can we make sense out of that? One of the best ideas I've ever had is called the smoke detector principle. And here it goes. I mean, we all put up with smoke detectors, right? That go off when we make toast or tea. And we put up with them because the cost of that is annoyance. And the cost of not having a smoke detector that's sensitive is death. But that's not going to happen very often. So I started asking myself, I mean, I saw thousands of patients with panic disorder. That was my specialty at the University of Michigan. We started one of the first anxiety disorders clinics. We got really good at treating people with anxiety disorders and panic. But I started asking myself, well, how come these people keep having panic disorder when they know perfectly well it's safe to go to the grocery store? And I finally realized that the cost of having a panic attack is like 100 calories and a lot of pain, but man. Of evolution, it wasn't very costly. In terms of not having a panic attack, well, if the alternative is a lion catching you, that's like 100,000 calories. So if you use a bit of fancy math called signal detection theory, that's like a ratio of, you know, 1,000 to 1 or something. And this means that the system is set to set off that panic attack anytime there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that there's a lion there. And that means that 999 times out of 1,000, it's a false alarm, but it's perfectly normal. And this is such an important principle. For some of my patients, they said, oh, I get it, Dr. Nessie. I'm not going to need you anymore, now that I know this. It was just wonderful, you know. They said, oh, so it's just a bunch of false alarms on a smoke detector? That's fabulous. So I don't know if that helps you at all, but it's a very profound principle, and it applies not just to anxiety. It applies to pain, fever, nausea, vomiting. I mean, what do doctors do? Do they usually cure diseases? No, mostly what we do is relieve symptoms. And when we relieve symptoms, we do it by using drugs that block normal systems, right? Block normal pain, block normal nausea, block normal cough. And the question is, so why don't we kill a lot of people doing that, right? If those things are so useful. And the answer is generally, and I'm making this all way over simple, but the general answer is the smoke detector principle.
So I think we need it to be oversimple.
Yeah, I think so. Well, no, I'm just like, so this makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint. It's like less risky or costly to our survival as a species to overreact.
That's right. Yeah.
Underreact.
So we could bring it to depression too, because that's what everybody's interested in. And there's this, did you know that depression rates in the United States are 8 times higher than in Korea? And what the hell is going on there? And the answer is nobody really knows. This is, I think, the most important question. If we could get our rates down to those in Korea and other places in Southeast Asia, that would do more good than all of us therapists put together.
I'm sure there's lots of theories, Dr. Nessie, you know, probably partly based on culture and putting community before self and stuff like that.
I think that's so important, Carrie. I mean, our culture is fragmented, isn't it? I mean, we move away from our families. We often don't have close friends nearby. And it's a pretty competitive culture. And there's not much of a safety net for people. I mean, people, you know, we're always on the edge, you know? So I think things feel risky to a lot of folks.
But I'm on my third city, Dr. Nessie.
What's that?
I'm on my third city, like for a living. My family's in Massachusetts. I moved to Florida, now in Tennessee. I have my husband's family with us, but I know exactly what you're saying. It's very...
And we're supposed to move to new places and make new friends. And I mean, it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
You know, what you do is you start a show and you make a bunch of new friends.
You know, if you can manage that, that is so fabulous. And that's great. Not everybody can.
Dr. Nessie, it's, you know, my selfish needs to talk about depression, but I am curious to know how much of, all right, well, you know how there's good gut biome stuff, good bacteria, that sort of a thing. We're only just now learning so much about that, for instance. What you're going after with things with depression, like, you know, maybe it's not all bad for you. Maybe, does that apply to a lot of the other psychological challenges that people may or may not have? Insofar as there's a lot of people wandering around figuring that they're pretty messed up. Maybe it's not such a bad deal for them to be so messed up. Is that reasonable to say or no?
You know, sometimes I mean, when you sit in a little office just with one person trying to help them, it's just this wonderful feeling of being useful and the like. And then sometimes you look out your window and you imagine millions of people out there who are struggling and trying to figure out what to do and how to cope and all that kind of stuff. And that's a lot of the reason why I kind of shifted from this, what's wrong with this person and why do they have this problem, to, hey, why is it, you know, all of us? And a lot of it has to do with natural selection shaping us with a bunch of emotions that aren't necessarily shaped to be good for us. They're shaped to be good for our genes. And in practical terms, this means that people think about sex a lot. not only do they think about sex a lot, but all kinds of things that don't, I mean, the ambition we all have, or most people have, some of it's to do good, stable things, but some of it's to be really grandiose, you know, and to have 20 women after us and all that kind of thing, or 20 men after us. Where does that get us really, you know? But we can't just turn it off because it's kind of built in. But it's so deep to try to understand. So are these bad feelings I'm having really trying to tell me about what I'm doing, or are they trying to get me to do something that might be good for my genes?
Oh, so you're supposed to have a talk with your genes. Like, maybe don't date 20 different guys right now. Let's settle down.
Full perspective, real easy. It is that, you know, emotions aren't just some glitch in your brain. Sometimes it's a glitch in the brain. Let's be clear about that. Absolutely. But other times, they're trying to tell you something. And sometimes what they're trying to tell you is good for you. And sometimes they're trying to trick you into doing stuff that's good for your genes. So the real message here, both for patients and therapists, is to really be patient and try to pay attention to what those things are and not jump to any general conclusions like they're always useful or they're always useless. You know, I think it really takes time on talking with people to try to figure out, should I pay attention to this or should I try to ignore it?
But Dr. Nessie, Chris and I were raised Catholic, so you just stuff those feelings. you don't examine
push them all
them.
Down.
Yeah.
Irish Catholic, no less. So.
It's even better.
That's quite a transition, actually, if you're no longer in the midst of that. Is it?
What's it? Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, I think it's interesting. I mean, I'm not a practicing Catholic. I gave it up for Lent. But I would say that it is interesting. And Robert Collins brought it up, too. He said, we're becoming more and more untethered to core institutions that shaped our bonds and community. I think a lot of what's happened is that we're all starting to kind of look around and go, wait a minute. Why did they make it this way anyway? Why is this system?
You're onto the question. That is just exactly the question. Yeah. But I think religion does a lot of people a lot of good.
Sure.
In addition to making a lot of people feel really guilty and awful.
Depends on the religion, Dr. Nessie, I guess.
Or the people in the building.
Yeah, and the person and people who are involved, it's just like everything else. Yeah. But most religions try to give people some set of goals in life that aren't just striving for sex and money. And I think it provides a refuge. I mean, instead of just we're all trapped in this damn competition for sex and money, it gives people a sense of deeper meaning if it's working right.
If you don't get sex and money, it's because that's the way it's supposed to be. That's religion. Well,
at least you don't have to blame yourself.
God's will. All right. I'm grabbing Tracy back.
Tracy
had a question way back when we were talking about how the birth canal is narrow. It, like evolutionarily, why is that?
Oh, I wish I had a simple answer to that, Tracy. There's big arguments about it, actually. A lot of people say that women's hips are a little bit different from men's so that they can give birth to babies. So it is wider, but they can't run as fast. And if they were able to run faster, their birth canal would be narrower yet. And so it's a trade-off between locomotion. But then there's some other very sophisticated studies that say, no, that's not really it. It has something to do with simply babies being bigger these days. Now that we all have McDonald's around the corner.
Wow. No, my babies were huge, actually. 9 pounds, 2 ounces.
For evolutionary medicine and evolutionary psychiatry, you don't just make up stuff. You come up with the 10 possibilities, and then try to figure out how to figure out which one might be true.
Chip says, let's stick with psychiatry.
What you were saying, Tracy, about the challenges of setting up a restaurant and how people can try things out at your place. And you must meet all kinds of entrepreneurs who are just getting started and really enthusiastic and ready to go. And you must have to try to counsel them and help them, or is that not your job?
Oh, you're muted, Tracy. You muted yourself.
Okay, I'm unmuted now. I'm no psychologist or psychiatrist, but I think people have to be ready to hear what other folks are saying. And so I try to be really gentle with people, especially if I know that this isn't going to work, and just give them the facts as I know them based on the information that they've given me, and then allow them to go forward, whatever that looks like. And it's, it can be kind of scary because then they'll come back and be like, oh, I should have listen to you because, this didn't work. And again, I don't really believe in failure. I think you either win or you learn. So if it doesn't quite work out, then
that's
you learn.
A wonderful phrase. I'm going to adopt that.
Absolutely.
When do you learn?
And I was going to ask you, as you were talking, so my journey to entrepreneurship and specifically Alamo Kitchen started with my youngest son, Theodore, who had lots of medical issues. He was born with a heart murmur and webbed vocal folds. We had all these, lots of allergies. And when we were living in the States, we got lots of medicine, and that's what they gave us. And so we got lots of scopes and lots of medicine. We had an opportunity to live in Europe. And when we moved to Europe, the doctors said, all right, we're going to give you the medicine, but we're going to also have you change your diet. And we changed the way we ate. I learned to make bread, and I would get up in the morning, make our bread, roast our chicken, and that would be what we would eat, right? And right. In Europe, they don't have fast food like we have it here. We were living in Brussels and they just don't have it the way we have it here. And we changed his diet. We changed everyone's diet and he got better, right? Exactly. He really got better. And so I really believe that food is medicine. And part of the reason that I started Alamo Kitchens was I always wanted to come back and teach people about food and how that really drives our body and our health. So the idea is that these people in the kitchen will then help me do that. But I wanted to ask you, as we talk about people's moods and anxiety and you know, paranoia or whatever it is, can food help drive that in a positive way? Have you found that at all?
You know, there's one big theory about depression that a lot of it has to do with inflammation. And inflammation, of course, can be increased by the kinds of food we eat. Along with food, there's exercise. And, you know, I always told my patients, oh, I got something even better for you than any of my pills. Really exercise. Really, really exercise. And one patient was just mind-blowing for me. She'd had like, you know, 7 different therapists before, and she had been on 13 different meds, and I was supposed to leave the country like in a week for a sabbatical. And she says, what can you do? I said, oh God, I don't know. I mean, geez, you've tried everything. And finally I said, will you try anything? And she says, yeah, I'll try anything. I said, okay, here's your prescription. Every day, I want you to spend 1 full hour in the treadmill foot blast. And after that, spend 1 hour walking around outdoors. And don't stop no matter how bad you feel. I don't care how depressed you are. Keep doing it. And she says, I'll do it. And I got this wonderful note a couple of months later from the people in the office saying, this woman called and said she just wanted to know that she'd tried 13 things before and she's been just fine once she started actually seriously exercising and taking care of herself. So these things are so important and they often don't get mentioned as much as they should. And it's hard for people. I mean, you can say exercise, but hey, here we are in COVID, here we are in freezing weather, here we are and we can't go to the gym. You know, I like what you said about, you know, you can't just give people advice because it's hard to follow a lot of times. And we got to sympathize with ourselves and with other people.
We have to forgive ourselves, right? I'm real big on that right now. I was with my brother last night and we were talking about, you know, he's an entrepreneur as well. And he was saying, you know, sometimes I just don't feel like going 100% and hitting it. And my response was, and that's okay too.
Pay attention to yourself, right?
Every day doesn't have to be 100%. And sometimes I think our bodies, our minds just need a break. And
imagine our ancestors at this time of year in some place where it's cold. I mean, the enthusiastic ones who were out saying, I don't care if it's 3 feet deep snow and 0 degrees out. I'm going to go find some food and kill something so we can eat something. Yeah, right? That person never came back. Those genes are gone. Right? But the one who just kind of sat back in the cave or wherever and said, I don't think I'm going to find anything. I'm kind of pessimistic. Those genes stuck around, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I mean, I think a huge thing for entrepreneurs is trying to figure out when do you quit. You learn something from failure, but I think when I started off in psychiatry, I encouraged all my patients, keep trying, you can do it, don't give up, keep trying, don't let it. Gradually, I learned more about life, and I realized some things are never going to work. And at some point, for some people, quitting, giving up on something. You know, if people say there's one cause of bad depression in terms of life situations instead of brain chemistry, I think it's pursuing an unreachable goal and not being able to give up.
But Randy, I would say don't quit, pivot.
Absolutely. Try a different strategy.
Right. If this isn't working, let's pivot and try something new, something different. Because eventually you'll turn and turn and turn and you'll look at the external environment, the internal, you know, everything that's going on within you, outside, what you're willing to do, what you have the skill set and the bandwidth to do, and you'll hit on something that works. So I'm not big
on that's how the system is.
I am big on pivot.
Well, that's how the system is designed. We all, you know, when you feel low, you don't just stop thinking. You start thinking a lot about what the hell am I going to do about this? And it always seems like the problem was unsolvable at first. And then you try to figure, hey, I got to really change something here. And I think that's a lot of what low mood is for, is to get you to make changes that are expensive and difficult and costly and risky and the like.
We've stumbled on the new talk show duo right here.
Yeah.
We're having a good time here.
And I would love to keep it going, but I have time. So I have to call time on this. But it is interesting to listen to this. One is to think of the fact that, you know, in regards to evolution, what is evolution but quitting a lot of times and pivoting? You know, evolution is that didn't work. Right. And I always tell people all the time, quit all the time, just don't surrender. You know, because one is different. One is, all right, this isn't the approach, but surrender is like someone made that decision for you. Mm-hmm. That's my sort of slice of the pie there. All right, so we have two things to do. We got to do person of the day.
And here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
Sorry, was that a vote for Dr.
No, I was just looking at, I wanted to see what he was saying.
See, Deanna, bye. No, I was just messing. But you know who I'm going to give it to, just because we haven't seen her around in a minute, so I want to give it to Nancy. So all females should be born with a zip in their abdomen.
All right. It would be so convenient.
I use a slide like that when I give lectures about evolution of medicine.
You should do it. Sense. Can we evolve a zipper?
That's one of those things, too, that's the difference between the way U.S. words and British words. U.S., we have a thing called a fanny pack. Over there, fanny is their kind of slang term for their front side. So she really wants a fanny pack, it turns out. So. Here's our question, which is, what goes in your backpack? Now, this could be something physical, like an avocado, and it could be something metaphorical, like hope for the future. So why don't we go with Dr. Nessie first? What kind of thing needs to go in your backpack?
So like everybody else, I mean, travel is off the table now, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I've been having a great time thinking about things I want to put in my little backpack or suitcase and take with me on international travels, but no, I guess not. I'm just kind of prosaic and simple. I have a really, really tiny down vest. And whether you're on an airplane or whether you're in a convention center in the South, it's just the right temperature and makes everything good. And it goes with my theme of adapting to what situation you're in, you know, and carrying something really tiny that helps you to adapt.
Love it. All right, Tracy Shelton, what goes in your backpack?
So I need a lot of things, but I'm just going to go with two. I need my blanket, my fleece blanket that wraps around my feet to keep me warm wherever I am. And lately, I cannot go anywhere without my library, access to the online library, so that I can listen to books on tape. Or I guess they're not on tape, books on audio.
I know. Isn't it funny how we all say those things, though? Books on tape, or, you know, things like rewinding, or that the phone is ringing. All these things that we have like that.
My backup car still has a tape player. Can't
use it.
Yeah, it doesn't work. I still have it. Yep.
Classic.
Yep.
Oh, my golly.
I know. But, you know, the car still works, and I hardly drive now, so...
There's a whole generation or more of people who were like into sales and whatnot that had to get all those sales tapes on tape. And we all drove around listening to our, you know, Zig Ziglars or whatever in the car and all those Nightingale Conant books and all that. My grandmother was not that kind of person. She worked in a factory and she was quite happy to have that job in a factory. But I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, with evolution, I think she would have been really down with this whole concept. Because she would have said, what goes in your belly impacts your mood a lot as well. And so one thing that she would have put in your belly